Welcome to the Pulse That Moves the Triangle World Today. This one-size-fits-all broadcast is a vibrant collection of stories, medical breakthroughs, helpful tips, what's trending, events, and boundless other adventures. It's a conversation pit of comedians, politicians, authors, chefs, sports figures, experts, the common and the uncommon. Here's the host of Triangle 411, Mary Innsbrucker.
Hi, friends. It's always been there. It's bathing in the shadows of wars, famine, floods, September 11th, and in just plain old everyday life. At times, it purchased its talons more predominantly than at others. Now with COVID-19, it's trickling in our veins again. It is the fear of dying. One of my mottos is, it's all about attitude. Apparently, there is a way to have a good attitude even about death. Enter death cafes. Have you heard about these gatherings where folks discuss demise over cake and coffee or even pizza? If you haven't, Triangle 411 is going to tell you about death cafes today. With us is J. Dana Trent, a professor of world religions at Wake Tech Community College in Raleigh, and a former hospital chaplain specializing in patient end-of-life care and family grief. In her most recent book, Dessert First, Preparing for Death While Savoring Life, readers learn practical tips on coping with death and grief, but through a sweet lens of levity. We'll talk about the book in a few minutes, but first Dana is here to educate us on death cafes. Welcome, Dana.
Thank you so much for having me, Mary. It's delightful to be here.
So, Dana, what is a death cafe, and how does it help people cope with and talk about death and grief?
A death cafe is the global movement started by John Underwood in 2011. It's what we call a social franchise movement, which is much like a commercial franchise like a McDonald's, but think about people as opposed to money and profit. So the death cafe movement has been represented, in over 100 countries, and there are nearly 12,000 death cafes around the world. And John Underwood started the movement in 2011 as a British Buddhist who was interested in making space, holding space, for people to come and talk about death, but with no agenda or no religious dogma or doctrine. He was simply inspired by the Swiss sociologist Bernard Crevaz, who first founded what's called the Café Mortel movement. But John took that movement and expanded it to make it an international movement.
So what about the death cafe movement in the United States?
Yes, and particularly with COVID, we're seeing something very interesting happen with the movement in the United States. So there are over 5,500 death cafes in the United States alone. So if you think about that, that makes up nearly half the global total of death cafes, which means that obviously they're very popular in America. And what we are seeing now with COVID is that death cafes, of course, are transitioning from in-person gatherings at a library, a cafe, someone's home, to virtual online gatherings. And in some instances, in some U.S. cities, that has worked very well, and death cafes have actually become a more popular tool for coping with COVID, the pandemic, the stress. But also in some areas, death cafes are dwindling, like in Raleigh. We have a death cafe presence in Raleigh in central North Carolina, but there is no longer an active physical group, and there's not really a virtual group. And so while there is a surge in death cafes in the United States, there's also an opportunity for us to create more virtual space for people, particularly during the pandemic.
Okay, so, but of course, with death cafes being worldwide, one only needs to search the internet for a location near them. And additionally, there are also online death cafes, correct?
That is exactly right. Yes. So if we were to reframe the COVID pandemic and the suffering and hurt that it's causing and triggering for folks, we could actually say that the silver lining, if you will, is that I, you know, living in Raleigh, could log on this afternoon to the Charlotte Death Cafe or the Virginia Death Cafe or the California Death Cafe. And you're exactly right, Mary. What once could have been geographic obstacles to gathering with people to talk about death are no longer there. And so in many ways, it's just a matter of going to find where everyone is. And you do that by going to deathcafe.com. You type in your zip code, or you can search, you know, within a 1,000-mile radius and see what may be happening virtually online near you or in California.
And California may have a way different take than Raleigh would have anyway, depending
exactly.
on your...
That's it. Yes.
Who you're
that's
with.
Precisely. Yes, that's right. I attended a Houston, Texas death cafe last fall when everything was still in person, and they did it a little bit differently than Greensboro, North Carolina. And so every physical space and online space does it a bit differently. But the essential rules of a death cafe are that there's always a facilitator. That facilitator holds safe space for folks. And then previously, when we met in person, there would always be food and drinks and some sort of sweet dessert in order to lighten the conversation with a little bit of levity, but also nourish our bodies so that we remember that even though we're talking about a really heavy subject, we're still here, alive, and in this moment with one another.
That's nice. Now, what was the difference between Texas and here? I'm just curious. You mentioned it was a little bit different.
Yes, actually, that's a great question. So here in North Carolina, what I experienced was actually in a public setting. So death cafes, folks can meet in actual cafes where you can order your own food, libraries, or, you know, in any kind of public setting. But the death cafe that I attended in Houston, Texas was in a rabbi's home. And I found that that was much more conducive to bringing out intimate conversation, which makes sense, right? It's obviously a safe space. It was very intimate. We had Oreos and snacks, and there were only 15 of us. And so very different from holding space in a public setting. But now in some, you know, what used to be the physical gatherings, perhaps the library or the coffee shop was the only option. But I do find that when death cafes are held in homes, you tend to get deeper quicker in terms of conversation. Now, the virtual setting has offered some really interesting insights into this. When I spoke to my friend this morning who runs the Houston Death Cafe, she said that while attendance in the virtual setting has declined for their death cafe, they've actually had more recurrence of regular visitors. And so, which means that people who are feeling isolated or people who really need this resource right now may show up more than a handful of times. This might actually become a normal, regular routine and space for them, as opposed to when it was held in person.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we have the whole COVID thing going on, so virtual is not a bad way to go. But again, with the whole COVID and we're so isolated, maybe some contact, you know, if we go by what our requirements about 10 people or less would also be good. So why do you think there's not any active? I know there used to be like a Hillsboro, I think, and Pittsboro and even downtown Raleigh. What happened to them?
Yeah. That's a great question. When I spoke to my friend this morning, she said, you know, I think we're all just zoomed out. And I heard that it can be taxing to meet and to be in a virtual space. And in some ways we long for connection during these days, but also in some ways thinking about and wrestling with death amid a pandemic can be completely overwhelming because we all have very unique situations when it comes to COVID-19, whether it's caring for children, you know, working from home or being ill ourselves, you know, contracting the virus and having to, you know, face a long recovery. There are just so many different factors that I think make it more complex than what it was 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully they'll come back around soon. But again, everything's virtual these days, so it's still a great mm-hmm. outlet. I want to kind of change the subject a dab here, still with the whole Death Cafe in mind. But Triangle residents are using the opportunity of the pandemic to think about their own mortality, their legacy, and what's really important to them. Pandemic death has brought life into focus. So as a professor of world religions at Wake Tech Community College, talk to us a bit on how the younger demographic at Wake Tech are eager to learn about how people of different spiritual and religious traditions cope with death.
That's a great question. Well, certainly you're exactly right. Triangle residents, this has brought this into sharp focus with the pandemic. And I think a lot of our conversations are happening one-on-one with one another over the phone or in neighbors' backyards. And certainly I experienced it in the Wake Tech Community College classroom in January through March. So in all of my world religion courses, we talk about death. We talk about the ways in which humans have coped with suffering historically via religious practices. And if you think about it, my students who may be 18, 19, and 26, they've grown up in a world with tremendous suffering. You mentioned earlier 9/11. They've grown up in the Great Recession. Now they're coping with a pandemic. Now one might say, well, how does that distinguish them from other generations of Triangle residents like baby boomers and Gen Xers? Well, the difference is that Wake Tech Community College students have a 24/7 news feed of suffering and death and pandemic and everything that has ever gone wrong. And they've had it since they were tiny children. And so they've grown up in the mix of this constant deluge of suffering and bad news. And what they want to know is, we know that this has happened before to humans. We know that our parents and grandparents have dealt with wars and they've dealt with violence, but how do we deal with it in this new normal of technology and social media and all these tools that we carry literally in our back pocket? And so many of our Wake Tech conversations in world religions are talking about ancient wisdom and how it applies today. How do you deal with suffering? How do you deal with death, especially in a world of shiny social media posts?
You've piqued my interest, and I wasn't going to stay long on this subject, but now I'm a little bit curious about the class itself. Because one of my questions was going to be, why are they so eager to learn? And you've answered that by saying the environment they've grown up in. And it's just so sad. It's so sad for our children to have to go through all the things that they go through. I mean, really. Mm-hmm. So again, I want to stay brief on it, but now I've just got to push a little further into that. So if you could, if this even makes sense, like an example in the class, you know, where they could find comfort. You talk about the wisdom. Is there something generalized you can say without getting into, you know, this religion versus that religion, but something generalized that they come away with?
Yes, that's a great question. And this is something that all Triangle residents can look to as well, of any generation. In fact, the Wake Tech students often go home and share this with their parents and grandparents and family members. And that is the Four Noble Truths from Buddhism. And it's a very simple concept, but it's just the idea that the Buddha taught that this world is full of suffering. And the sooner that you realize that, the sooner you can do the work, which is called the Eightfold Path, of trying to have right mind, right concentration, right action, and all of the ways in which we can be quote-unquote wise. And it's simply the awareness of the suffering that in many ways alleviates the suffering, because it shows the students to each other in the classroom, and then when they take it home to the older generations, that you're not alone in this. All of humanity suffers. Everyone has unique circumstances. And so what tools do we have, like meditation and prayer and gatherings and death cafes, to go full circle, to help us cope with this? And I think that's a very great question right now, not just for Wake Tech students, but for all Triangle residents.
True. Very true. So let's get back to your book a little bit, because this can help just as much as a death cafe, I think. Dessert first, preparing for death while savoring life. So again, for the Wake Tech students or our listeners, everybody out there who may not want to attend a death cafe, how can your book help them at home, especially during quarantine in this COVID-19 crisis?
Yes. Thank you, Mary, for asking that and bringing that up, because it's true. Death cafes are not for everyone. You know, so many of us are feeling really overwhelmed right now in the Triangle. We have a lot going on. And so if you can have a concrete tool like a book, and the way we have organized dessert first is that you can dip in and out of it. And even if you spend 5 minutes here and 5 minutes there, it's very easy to digest. And the book is based on my chaplaincy work at UNC Chapel Hill. So I'm a Duke Divinity School graduate, and then I did a postgraduate residency in chaplaincy at UNC, which simply means that I was a hospital chaplain specializing in end-of-life care. And the book compiles all of the lessons that my patients and their families taught me about death, dying, and grief, from what to do and say at the bedside of a loved one, or now it would be the telephone, right? Or FaceTime, and what rituals to do after death, which have also changed given COVID. But then probably most importantly down the road for everyone, how do we cope with the grief? What are some really practical things that we can do to cope with grief? For instance, one of the basic tools that I offer folks is to keep a grief notebook. And I encourage everyone listening in the Triangle to keep a pandemic notebook. That's simply a little journal where you write down a few things that you're feeling or thinking about every day. It doesn't have to be complicated. It can be bullet points. And just noticing the patterns and trends of what's happening in your grief can often be a big relief to people, because it helps them name the pain and the suffering, going back to the Four Noble Truths in Buddhism. And so often I think when we bring up hurt, we are shut down. Either we shut ourselves down or others shut us down. And so I think to have a grief notebook or a pandemic notebook is a great tool right now for coping with really complex emotions. And that's just one of the many tools in the book that I offer. I talk about everything from how to prepare for death in terms of legal forms and healthcare, which is very important. Mary, I don't know if you know this, but you know, by 2030, all of the baby boomers will be 65 years old or older, and only one-third of Americans have end-of-life healthcare plans. So obviously, with, you know, 3.5 million confirmed cases of COVID, that's a big deal that two-thirds of us don't have an end-of-life healthcare plan.
Now, so things like that. Let me stop you a minute. What do you mean by end-of-life healthcare plan?
Great question. So what that means is, I'll use myself as an example. I'm 39. If I were to be diagnosed with COVID and it were a very serious case that required a ventilator and all kinds of healthcare treatment, how much treatment would I want? And at what point would I want my healthcare power of attorney, who's my husband or my brother, if my husband's not available, to say, no more curative care. We are transitioning her to comfort care only. So those are the decisions to think about now. Because when we do that, as painful as it is the greatest gift to ourselves and to our families, because it keeps them from having the burden of making those really tough decisions in a crisis.
So this kind of sounds like the do not resuscitate, et cetera, kind of thing, which, you know,
correct.
I have experienced myself, you know, not having to make that decision is like beyond, I mean, you're just going through so much at that time, then to have to make that call is again, exactly like you say, a burden. So it's good when people do take that burden off of others. I want to go back to a couple things. One of the things, and I'm just wondering about this because I've wondered about this my whole life. You said, like in the book, it kind of talks about when you're dealing with someone dying, and what is like the best thing you can say to someone who's, let's just say their mother died. I mean, they always say, don't say things like, you know, oh, well, she was so sick, so this is better, and or she's in a better place. And there's like a lot of things that people think are good to say, but they're really not. What is the best thing you can say to comfort someone who has just lost someone?
I actually say that the best practice is showing up and saying nothing at all. And what I mean by that is that when I was a chaplain, I described myself as a human Tupperware container. So my best friend, who is now experiencing an anticipatory grief, there's a family member who of hers that is close to dying. My practice with her right now is showing up, reaching out for her, listening to whatever she's feeling and saying and thinking about, but not telling her that, you know, heaven needs another angel or it's going to be okay, because you're right. That language is not useful or helpful. So Kate Bowler, who's also a triangle expert on death and grief, says it's the practice of showing up and shutting up, which means that often we don't need to say anything. Often people just need someone to listen. And that's actually exactly what John Underwood, the Death Cafe founder, said, people just need a space to talk and people to listen. And that's what it boils down to, just showing up and shutting up.
Okay. That's tough though, because you want to say something, you want to give comfort, but I hear what you're saying.
Yes.
And in your
book, so often, oh, go ahead.
No, that's okay. You go ahead.
I was going to say, so often, to put people's minds at ease in the triangle listening, when you show up and shut up and listen, what's called active listening, people will actually give you the language that they need to hear. And so you can practice reflecting back what you heard from them. And so just listening to the words that they're using, you can say, I hear that you feel really angry. I'm hearing that this feels terrible, because it is terrible. So those are the kinds of things that I urge people to do when they want to say something, is to practice active listening and reflect words back to folks who are grieving.
That's a good tool. I think that's a good tool, because you feel like if you just sit there that people think you're not paying attention or listening or caring. And so you can reflect back to them like in that manner. It at least acknowledges. So I like that one. Now, your book does help with, again, with COVID, as far as our fears, anxiety, depression.
All of that. Yes. Because death is no longer invisible. You know, when we first released this book pre-COVID, we were sort of dealing with the unnamed. People weren't talking about death when this book was first released, and now it's everywhere. You know, we are up to nearly 50,000 deaths in the United States alone, Mary. That's a lot. That's a lot. And so death is on our minds. And the book covers how to deal with anxiety and depression and anger and all the five stages of grief, and simple tools for coping with those, including, you know, meditation, grief notebooks, rituals, things that people can do that are very accessible, that also allow them to do what they need to do, but also stay grounded in the present. Because I know sometimes when you start having death conversations and do death work, it can be overwhelming. And so the idea is that you do it a little bit at a time, because I know a lot of folks' fear is that once you start talking about death, either you're going to invite death in or you're going to get so down and depressed, it's going to be hard to dig out of that hole. So that's why the title of the book is Dessert First. We start with something sweet, and that helps bring levity to the entire situation.
Interesting. Okay. And so that was probably your biggest surprise when writing and releasing the book on death, especially in the middle of the pandemic, right?
Oh, totally. Yes. None of us obviously could have predicted that this would happen, but I'm so grateful for the timeliness of the tool because, Mary, I cannot tell you how many calls and texts and reach outs that I've gotten that people who have said, my neighbor, her parent has been diagnosed with COVID or the parent has died. I'm going to give her your book as a tool for what to do right now, the next steps. I'm going to think about having conversations with my loved ones and family members over dessert and so bring some levity to the situation because death is on our minds. It's here. It's on our televisions and on our phones. So let's talk about it because it's kind of like a free market economics, if you will. When you realize that there's scarcity to life, it makes it all that more precious. It's like supply and demand, and we realize how precious now our moments and our minutes and our days are.
Well, for other folks who'd like to get your book or information for free resources, grief guides, tips, and articles on the subject, where should they go, Dana?
Yes. So you can find me at jdanatrent.com. There are free guides on there, free resources, and then I love to connect with folks via social media. So it's at jdanatrent on Twitter, Instagram, jdanatrentauthor on Facebook, and also jdanatrent YouTube. So I've got a YouTube channel full of Ask a Grief Guru series where I eat s'mores and talk about listeners' questions that they've submitted about practical, just like what we've talked about, but also kind of the larger life questions pertaining to death. So I'd love to connect with anyone in the Triangle and help however I can.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for being here and what you are doing to help folks through this type of process, COVID or in non-COVID times.
Thank you so much, Mary, for having me, and thanks for making space to talk about all this.
Now it's time for our nonprofit spotlight. In January of 2013, Michelle Old formed the Diaper Bank of North Carolina with the hopes of providing 50,000 diapers in her community within the year. Now, the Diaper Bank has distributed over 13 million diapers statewide with branches in the Triangle, the Greater Triad, and the Lower Cape Fear region. Their mission is to ensure that families in need have adequate supply of diapers, to improve access to personal hygiene products, to distribute basic needs through community partners, to enhance the community understanding of the need, and to create a diaper bank model that can be shared, replicated, and adopted by all counties in North Carolina. If you need diapers, want to donate, or get involved, as well as hear about their COVID-19 period operations, please visit ncdiaperbank.org. ncdiaperbank.org. Well, it's time to high five and say goodbye. We're everywhere. iTunes, Apple, Spotify, iHeartRadio, etc. Or you can always catch us on our website, triangle411.buzzsprout.com. I'm Mary Innsbrucker for Triangle 411. Today, lend a hand.